For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary. Janet Mills is Maine's current Attorney General. She was District Attorney for Androscoggin, Franklin, and Oxford counties from 1980 to 1992. Mills was then elected to the Maine House of Representatives, where she served from 2002 to 2008, when her peers elected her as Maine's first ever female Attorney General. In 2014, she again won the post, in which she continues to serve. Mills holds a bachelor's from the University of Massachusetts and a law degree from the University of Maine School of Law. Maine Public's Steve Missler spoke with Mills in our Augusta studios.
But what specific proposals makes you different than your opponents?
Look, I'm proposing to bring people together and get the state on a forward footing again. I think I have the ability to take charge on day one and bring the parties together to accomplish things in the area of health care and education and economic development. For instance, I know the ins and outs of state government, although I've also been in the private sector for 14 years representing individuals and small businesses and all kinds of matters. But I also know the state budget. I'm the only person in this race who's from the 2nd Congressional District. I'm the only person in this race who's actually served on the Appropriations Committee for 4 years. We did 7 budgets in 4 years during some of the toughest economic times in Maine history. So I have that experience to bring to the job. Specific proposals are like, well, for instance, doing data warehousing, using some of the old mill facilities and combining that with geothermal to spin off a lot of heat, enough heat and energy to supply hundreds of homes and small businesses in the areas that we're talking about. So I have specific ideas and a statewide strategy for broadband, which is huge, huge importance to the state of Maine. And I know how to do that. I've been talking to all the players. I know how to combine bonds with other funding sources and get the job done.
What is the biggest challenge facing Maine, and what would you do as governor to respond? There's a little bit of a dovetail here with that first question, but what do you think the biggest challenge is?
Well, first, I want to bring people together again. I don't want a Maine that is divided. My vision of Maine is undivided, prosperous from north to south, from west to east, incentivizing, encouraging the economic development in the 2nd Congressional District and in the Rim counties and Aroostook, which have fallen short in the economic development area and have not had the advantages of higher real estate prices and lower unemployment rates that Cumberland County has had, for instance, in York County. So I want to bring technology jobs. I want to bring good-paying trade jobs to other parts of Maine that aren't as lucky as Cumberland County. Mm-hmm. And I think I can do that.
Polls show that this, what you're talking about, is very important. That's the economy. And I get the sense from your first response that there's been winners and losers in the recovery that we've had.
Right.
How do you get more winners into places that are not winning right now?
Well, first, you've got to market the state. It feels like there was a book many years ago that said, we've been down so long, it looks like up to us. And to me, although there have been great points in our economy and low unemployment rates, more people are working 2 and 3 part-time jobs just to get by, including in southern Maine. And we're attracting fewer and fewer millennials, fewer and fewer young families. So to do that, we've got to market the state of Maine. I want to be the biggest cheerleader for the state of Maine. I want to tell the world what a great place we are, what great people we have, what a great work ethic we have, what great natural resources, and what a great place to live, work, and play. So to do that, you need research and development. You need education, equal opportunity for education, and you need infrastructure, meaning not just roads and bridges, but laying fiber. When you rebuild a road or a sewer line or water line, lay fiber too, and let's build up that broadband infrastructure.
Nationally, Maine ranks relatively low in its rate of gun violence, but nearly half of domestic violence homicides in this state involve guns. Should Maine's gun laws be changed? And if so, how?
Yes. In fact, Senator Dion and I are the only two candidates who have actually been in the trenches recently fighting for a bill that would allow a judge to remove a gun from somebody who poses a high level of serious dangerousness to the public.
This is the red flag.
The red flag bill. And I personally drafted an amendment to that bill as well that both sides, Republicans and Democrats, in the committee adopted in their proposals, and the Sportsman's Alliance of Maine approved of. And that would allow a judge to take a gun away from someone in an outpatient commitment posture who has been determined to be dangerous for X number of reasons. And it provides for due process for those individuals. This is a temporary prohibition, a restraint on gun ownership and gun possession. I thought that might fly right now. It seems to be stuck in the purgatory of the legislature right now. Look, I mean, here's how I feel about it. I've been to the scenes of many, many homicides and some suicides, and I've held the hand of many people who have lost loved ones to gun violence, including suicide. And I think Senator Dion's bill would have gone a long ways to prevent suicide as much as anything. We talk about domestic violence, we talk about homicide, we forget the horrendous number of suicides by gun that we have in the state of Maine, and that's a tragedy on its own. I also was part of the bill when I was on Judiciary Committee. We got the players together, all the stakeholders together, and we passed a bill out of committee unanimously that allows the judge to take guns away from domestic abusers. That was a huge victory, and it went through the House and Senate unanimously and was signed by the governor into law. And that was a great victory, and it has saved hundreds, if not thousands, of lives. But that's how you do it. Whatever the piece of legislation is, you've got to get everybody at the table and say, well, how can we work together? You don't make people your enemies if they disagree with you. You talk to them and listen to them.
So Maine right now is currently enjoying very low unemployment rate, but it ranks 44th nationally in median household income. I'm sure you've heard that statistic before. How do we get wages up here?
Well, it's not just wages going up, it's also bringing down the cost of living. Because no matter what your wage is, and no matter how much we increase the minimum wage, for instance, if you're not taking home any more money in your pocket, you're not going to feel it. Mm-hmm. So bringing down the cost of health care is an important factor. Bringing down the cost of energy and electricity and transportation, those are all factors that make people feel better and take home more money, feel more capable of caring for their families, supporting their families. So bringing better wages means high-tech jobs and innovative jobs in the creative economy mean greater broadband. We can no longer afford to be a dial-up state in a broadband nation. We're like almost last in the country, and partly because we're a rural area and we have all these crazy peninsulas, and it's really difficult to lay fiber or something important like that, or cable even, along those tough stretches of land. But we've got to accomplish that, not to every house in town, but to the centers of economy that could be developing across our rim counties and northern Maine.
Maine is one of the more expensive states for electricity customers. You've just alluded to this, although it's lowest in New England. As governor, how can you lower power costs?
Oh, great question. And there are things going on in this state. For instance, Booth Bay has something called an Ice Bear project, and they're eliminating the need for a new power line to go down that peninsula by incorporating, and I can't begin to describe it, but an energy saving thing, energy storage and energy saving, electricity saving mechanism that allows them to heat and cool their homes and businesses at off-peak hours and whatnot. Those are the kinds of innovative things we can be doing to lower the cost of electricity. Obviously, conservation and weatherization. We have one of the highest percentages of mobile homes in the state. And to the extent that they're heated with electricity, they're very difficult to weatherize because of the amount of exposed space and lack of foundations and whatnot. So we got to accomplish that in a different way, weatherizing homes, including mobile homes, in an efficient way. Conservation, efficiency, and we've got the opportunity potentially for offshore wind. The governor of New Jersey just announced an offshore wind project there that will generate 3,500 megawatts of power, enough to provide power to 1.5 million homes. Well, we better start down that road too, because they're way ahead of us, and all the investors and suppliers are going there, and Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Rhode Island, not to Maine, unless we take steps.
A lot has been made over the years about attracting businesses to this state. And some believe that tax incentives are one way to do that, whether it's pine tree zones or the Better Betty programs, which reimburse businesses for purchases they make to grow their business. Do you see those programs as effective economic development tools, or are they, as some people will call them, corporate welfare?
Some of each. Mm-hmm. I just toured a business yesterday in Lewiston that is incredible, something called Grand Rounds. They employ about 80 people in Lewiston, and they're anxious to employ more. And it's a beautiful workspace, and they pay really good wages and benefits. That's an example of something that's used the pine tree zones without a lot of empty promises. There have been some entities that used pine tree zones and in order to compete with existing businesses. So the existing businesses got the short end of the stick. There are also other corporations. Some look at Kate Street, for example, which took millions of dollars from the state of Maine and just ran away with it. We can't let that happen. We need something in the nature of a clawback. When we're going to give huge tax breaks to individual companies on the promise of higher employment, we better make them pay up. We better make them do what they promise or pay us back.
What about Maine's welfare system? There's been a lot of changes. There have been high-profile changes, very controversial changes in some ways. Is Maine's welfare program working? Is it too generous, falling short just right? Is it lifting people out of poverty, which is their design? That's what they're designed for.
I think the cuts to the SNAP program were disgraceful. I think the cuts to the TANF program were unnecessary, and we're hurting children. We have more children who are food insecure, going hungry basically, going to school without breakfast. We have, I think, 1 in 5 of our school-aged children are going without food to the extent they need to be having food. So that's a problem. I think we've neglected our children under this administration. I think the children's cabinet, by law, has not met in seven and a half or eight years. We need to be looking at children from the point of view of corrections, Long Creek, mm-hmm. point of view of education, CDS, pre-K, point of view of HHS, child protection and the like, children's services, looking at our kids in a holistic fashion, not siloed by whether they're in trouble with the law or flunking out of school or in danger in their homes. That's one way that the current administration, I think, has fallen down.
Well, you mentioned the changes to TANF and SNAP.
Yeah.
I'm assuming you're referencing the five-year cap on TANF benefits. What changes in SNAP?
Well, and the money not spent, too.
Right.
It was like, what, $8, $9 or $10 million that's, for some reason, not spent on providing, encouraging healthy families. Now, I am not including Medicaid or Maine Care in the category of welfare. I know some do. I do not. That's not welfare. That's health care. But in terms of so-called welfare, that is emergency assistance, social assistance, I think we can do better, do more, provide incentives to for people to get trained in jobs that they're not qualified for now. I represented people in private practice who were in dire need of services and who had a tough time getting off of the welfare train because they didn't have the education or training to get where they wanted to go and needed to go. And the state government can do a lot better to provide a helping hand to those people.
The voters, as you know, overwhelmingly approved expanding Medicaid at the polls last year. Yet the legislature and the governor have not been able to come together to find a way how to fund the state's share. There's a lot of reasons for that, which I'm sure you'll get into. But how would you go about bridging that divide? It's become very ideological and partisan. And so how do you talked a lot about bringing people together. How do you fund the state share of Medicaid expansion and bridge that political divide that you've talked about?
Well, I think you look at it from 2.2 aspects. One is providing the funds to provide care, and secondly, providing the controls and regulations to cap the costs. So you look at expenditures and you look at benefits. And we've got to go be careful about it. All that I have read, including the Manat report, indicate that it's not going to be that expensive in year one, at least. And by the end of year one, we'll know better how to plan for the next years. I don't think anybody has the genius to know exactly what it's going to cost 5 or 6 years from now. And it will depend on future legislatures as well as future governors to determine how to implement the plan. A lot of people talk about expanding it further and making it a single-payer plan. I think that that would be lovely in an ideal world, but you would need the cooperation of the federal government to do that, and I don't see that happening. Mm-hmm. We could be talking to New Hampshire and Vermont, some, you know, the upper tier of New England, and talking to them about sharing some kind of health care programs. Vermont tried single payer and didn't get implemented. They had to walk it back. I mean, we've got enough for the startup costs. Mm-hmm. We've got enough to get the ball rolling. We will know better a year from now. Even worst case scenario, according to the Manat report and according to the statistics looked at by the Appropriations Committee and their nonpartisan staff, the Medicaid fund will not need any money until a year from May 2018 to the end of. So not until the end of May 2019 will there need to be any more influx of money, state money. So that gives you time to look at that and very carefully track the enrollments, track the claims filed, track the costs of care, and be able to do an actuarial analysis. But I think it's so important. There are people out there who are dying because they don't have basic preventative care. And it's inhumane not to get them in the system and get them the care they need.
Does the state pay its fair share of local education costs, in your view? You know, it's supposed to fund 55%. There was a measure on the ballot 2 years ago that would have added more money. And now that provision is gone and that money has been dispensed, but it's going to run out.
Well, I'd love to see it be more than that, because what I hear around the state is our complaints about the property taxes right now. And that's driven in good part by two things. One, education funding, or the shortfall in state support for education. And two, revenue sharing being cut back. So the towns are picking up higher police, fire, and education costs. So we've got to look at that. No, I think the state can pay more. Look, why do we have $140 million in surplus? What's driving that? Where are we getting too much money from? Mm-hmm. And can that be funneled into a longer-term support for education? Mm-hmm. Let's look at that. And let's look at the EPS formula, too. There's still a tremendous amount of disparity between the rich towns and the poor towns. Let's face it, no matter what the state share is. And there's tremendous amount of disparity among teacher salaries.
You've talked a lot about helping rural Maine. And one of the things that rural Maine is facing, I think, and probably the whole state is that Maine is experiencing a teacher shortage. How do you incent more teachers to consider a career in that field? And how do you get them to some of these rural areas when they could be drawn to maybe a wealthier school district to get a better paycheck?
Some of the rural areas do have a good tax base. They've got waterfront and oceanfront, things like that. So I don't want to categorize it. I don't want to stereotype those districts. But the service centers are just as impoverished as many rural areas because they don't have the tax base. And they don't have waterfront properties necessarily. So I come from an education town. UMF supplies the greatest number of teachers in the state of Maine through the university teaching program. So I'm all in favor. My mother was a teacher for 37 years, taught with Chandler Woodcock. And I think we've got to provide a teacher a loan forgiveness program. We have some limited loan forgiveness programs now, but we can do better by teachers coming out of the university system. If something like 40% of our teachers are going to be eligible for retirement in the next few years, it's an older crowd. It is just, and nursing is, there's a shortage in nursing too. So it's not unique to teaching, the fact that we're running out of people to in those professions. I think the Maine Quality Centers, supported by the community college system, can help pair professions with workforce needs all around the state, including teaching needs.
Let's switch to the referendum process. Do you think it's working as intended? It's certainly created a lot of problems in the legislature. There's been a lot of changes to overhaul it, to change it, to make it maybe harder to get on the ballot. Do you think that it should be changed in any way? And if so, how?
Well, first, when I'm governor, we won't be governing by veto. So we won't be forcing people to go to the ballot box and start initiative petitions on every piece of public policy that ought to be addressed by the legislature in a democratic, small d, democratic fashion. We'll get the parties together. When there's a good idea, we'll all work on it. The lack of participation by the chief executive in the legislative arena has brought people to the desperate point of having to go draft initiatives. and start from scratch. And they're not always drafted well. I mean, that's a given, because they don't have public hearings. They don't have work sessions like you do in the open process in the legislature. And I would love to see a more open process. If people feel they need to do a referendum or initiative, open it up to the public so people get some input at the outset. You know, people accuse me of being against the marijuana bill. I'm not against recreational marijuana. Mm-hmm. I'm fine with recreational marijuana. But the bill, the 30-page bill, was very flawed. And then they kept saying, well, it will need to be tweaked. Well, then it took a large committee of legislators 6 months to do a 70-page bill to fix the 30-page referendum, and then that got vetoed, and then they're still working on fixing it. So it'd be good to do some better drafting in the first place, but I'm hoping there won't need to be all these referenda and initiatives when I'm governor.
There is this working theory that the country is so polarized right now, and Maine too, that it's best for elected officials to really just kind of work to keep their supporters happy. I think the term that gets thrown around is base governing.
The base.
Yeah, and that the idea that building coalitions could actually alienate those hardcore supporters. Do you believe that that's actually happening? Is that happening here? And how can you change that if it is?
What you've just talked about is not something that Olympia Snow or Margaret Chase Smith or George Mitchell or Bill Cohen or Ed Muskie would ever have agreed with. That's not the way they governed, even in very polarizing times in the United States Senate and in the Congress. I'd like to bring us back to times where diplomacy and civility count for something, and being civil to your opponents counts for something. And that's how you get things done. I mean, do you think George Mitchell got the Clean Air Act amendments done in the early 90s by polarizing the automobile industry? I don't think so. Do you think he got the Irish peace accords done? 700 days of disagreement and one day of peace, one day of agreement. It's about being patient and getting people to the table.
Candidates for governor, I haven't heard it so much this campaign, but they often talk about transparency in government. How important is it that people know what their government is up to?
Of course it's important, and it's important that they know not just the spin from some state agency or some politician or some department head or legislator or local politician. It's important that they know the whole story, not just the sloganeering and the spin and the press releases, that they be invited to ask questions and get responses.
Right now, I think a lot of reporters in Maine are experiencing this, at least those that are covering the State House, and that is what appears to be a gaping hole in our public records law, where we can ask for things and we'll get a response within 5 days, documents, public documents, but we may not see those documents. But I have some requests that are out. They're years
I know,
old.
I know.
How do we get that so we're not also putting too much of a burden on state agencies, knowing that sometimes public records law can be weaponized by either attorneys or, you know, political opponents?
Yeah, I mean, I've gotten freedom of access requests from out-of-state entities, you know, political entities that I have no idea what they're really looking for. They don't want to tell me. So you call them and write them and say, what do you really want? Just tell me what you really want. I'll get it to you if I have it. But this is all this obfuscation game, you know. Well, I want every invoice of every, you know, conference that anybody in your office ever went to for 10 years. Well, what are you really looking for? Mm-hmm. So I think, both sides need to play fair. In Vermont, I think the Attorney General of Vermont has done an interesting thing. He's puts up on his website every freedom of access request and every response. Because just because you request something and it becomes public to you doesn't mean somebody else might want it too. Mm-hmm. And that's an interesting concept I'm toying with. It takes some work, that's all. It takes some clerical work, staff work. So that everybody knows what's being requested and you don't duplicate things. I think it's important that they be responded to in timely fashion. What timely fashion means, you know, if the governor went to Washington 14 months ago and stayed at a Trump hotel, I think he shouldn't take 12 months to respond to that FOIA request. That should be at the ready.
Beyond signing bills into law, how can the governor really improve the lives of Mainers?
Sure. I mean, you're talking about the bully pulpit that can be used for ill or good, and I hope to use it for good. I want to, again, I want to be the biggest cheerleader for the state of Maine. I want to tell the world what a great state we are. We're wonderful people and great natural resources. And to some extent, if you build it, they will come. If you tell them about it, they will come. There are things you can do in a symbolic way. There are things you can do in a legislative way, things you can do by executive order. And I'm familiar with all those. You know, I've been in the public sector. I've also been in the private sector. And I've represented Maine people in all kinds of, all fashions. But I know how to change things by changing attitudes, too. For instance, in the area of the opiate epidemic, we need to destigmatize people with substance abuse disorders. We need to encourage them to find help and provide the proper treatment geared to their individual needs wherever they are in the state of Maine. That hasn't been done yet, and I want to do that. I want to get the word out that 211 or 211 on steroids for people with substance abuse disorders means something, means they can find help. When I'm governor, somebody will answer the phone. If it's a laid-off worker looking for unemployment, somebody will answer the phone. If it's a teacher or a police officer or a doctor calling in a child abuse case, somebody will answer that phone. And if it's a person with substance abuse disorder or a member of the family looking for help, somebody will answer that phone and they will get them help. You got to have a government that's responsive.
Maine has received failing grades for the condition of its infrastructure, and it currently has a big backlog of deferred maintenance on roads and bridges. The response has been to bond, go out and ask voters to borrow money to pay for infrastructure.
Sure.
Is that a sustainable way to pay for roads and bridges, or do we need to rethink it, think of something else to do to pay for that?
It's sustainable as long as there's a 9-to-1 federal match for a lot of those projects, and it's sustainable as long as interest rates are fairly low, mm-hmm. those two things.
Yeah, what happens when they're not?
You don't bond as much. You try to pare back some. And then the other issue, the challenge facing the next administration is the gas tax. Because mm-hmm. I'm supportive of electric vehicles. I don't have one, but I'm supportive of them. I encourage people to buy them to reduce their carbon footprint. But the more people who have hybrids and electric vehicles, the less gas tax we're taking in, mm-hmm. the less revenue for the state for highways. To the transportation budget. We've got to look at that. Other countries have this sort of toll system. It's kind of spooky almost, but you know, they have these laser things that tell you where you've been and how far your car has gone, and they send you a bill. Mm-hmm. But if they can do it, we ought to look at those kinds of alternatives to the gas tax.
What are Maine's three greatest assets, and how do you best leverage those qualities to improve Maine's economy?
Sometimes our competitive advantages are not what we think of as assets. I talked about data warehousing. You know, I go to meetings and I say to the lobbyists from Google and Microsoft and others, I say, where do you store your data? Well, Atlanta, Georgia, I think. Well, you must pay millions in air conditioning. Look, we got something up in Maine that you'd like. We have cold, and we have a solid bedrock of granite. Mm-hmm. Nothing moves. No earthquakes, no seismic events. We don't think of these as assets necessarily, but they can be assets, and we need to look at them differently and market them differently. Our greatest assets are our people and our natural resources, those two major things. Location is not so great in terms of transportation, but our deep ports are a major asset. And we need to market that more as well. So our people and our natural resources, we can enhance those by, again, assessing the infrastructure, expanding infrastructure, including not just roads and airports, but broadband mm-hmm. and cell phone coverage. Doesn't that make you mad every time you get mile 47 coming up or going back from the state's largest city to the state's capital and back? You lose a call. You drop a call. What the heck is that about? I'm sorry. We've got to get into this 21st century. I want to take us there.
Thanks for listening to this interview, part of Maine Public's Your Vote 2018 election coverage. I'm Mal Leary.